our meeting and you can continue on part two, please.
Thank you. Okay, so picking up where use permits are, so the idea about the use permit in comparison to the administrative use permit, it's still discretionary, but it goes to the Planning Commission for approval in the normal discretionary approval process that you're used to for use permits. So these would be publicly noticed. It would go out to property owners within 300 feet. It would also have to go be posted on your website, be agendized, like a standard public hearing would be. And really, those are state mandated requirements when it comes to noticing the public hearing requirements. And then in these cases, use permits would always require a public hearing and noticing. It would also be subject to the appeals procedures in which an appeal would have to be filed, a fee paid at the time of the appeal application as existing practice, and then would have to go through its normal appeals process, which we'll talk about a little later in this presentation. The other type of permit that we're looking at that is included in this section is the vacation rental activity permit. This establishes a permitting process for your vacation rental land uses and vacation rentals. So it defines the application contents, the review authority, who's reviewing, the procedures for that review, and the appeals procedures. Also establishes operational standards and requirements for these types of land uses and cross-references out to the other applicable sections of the Code of Ordinances and of the Zoning Code. This section in this permit also establishes its own inspection and compliance requirements, enforcement and revocation procedures, and also renewal requirements for users and applicants of vacation rentals. And ultimately, really, this permit is intended to ensure that these types of land uses continue to serve, we talked about in Title I, your public safety and welfare. That we are not creating situations where we have conflicting land uses of noise or over parking, which I think vacation rentals can have the potential to do if not regulated and enforced properly. So really, this gives you that enforcement mechanism, that tool for regulating, I would say, these types of land uses. Furthermore, we refined an existing process that the county has for planned development plans. Think of these as mini zoning codes or special development standards that applicants can request. This is an existing process that jurisdictions really as a best practice incorporate, in which applicants can request a specific different development standards than what your zoning code is requiring. Has to go through an entirely separate process, has to go through the Planning Commission for their review. Ultimately, though, it has to be consistent with your general plan, but kind of another off-ramp of opportunity where if someone, an applicant, doesn't necessarily want to follow the strict standards of your zoning regulations, they can apply for this other discretionary route where they can propose something that's of higher quality for review and consideration by the commission. And then much of the existing language as it pertains to your existing sign permit and your variance procedures have retained. So your variance procedure is a state mandated requirement. There are certain findings that need to be made and qualifications that an applicant can qualify for in order to request a variance. But variances are kind of those requests in which an applicant is requesting a change based on specific findings, whether that be economic or not being able to fully utilize their land to its full potential. The state requires that there is a process that jurisdictions adopt where they can allow such variations or deviations to certain standards. And then your sign permit. Again, nothing much really changed with your sign permit. This is an existing process. Really just refined it, the language for consistency in review authority titles and some of the language that we implemented in other parts of the code. So with that will conclude the summary of part two. I will hand it back to the chair for any questions or clarifications that we can provide on this part.
Great, thank you. Commissioner Fowle, you want to start?
I have two to begin with. Okay. First question, and I wasn't aware of this, page 57, number 6 under application filing procedures for the vacation rentals, it says certification that the applicant does not possess another active vacation rental activity permit within the unincorporated area of the county. When did that become county ordinance, county law? That
it's been that way, sir, since the beginning of Article 61.
So an individual can only have one vacation rental in the county of Siskiyou?
Let me look at the section. No, but only you can only have one vacation rental per property, right? Per parcel.
Okay, per parcel makes sense.
So.
But that's not what this says.
Yeah.
I take this as only allowed one vacation rental within the unincorporated area of the county. It's well, not parcel specific.
Yeah, because that's exactly what it says. It's one per county is what that says.
And that's why I don't recall that ever being a restriction in Siskiyou County. Per parcel, yes.
Right.
I concur.
I'll have to look to see when that was carried over, but we should be able to strike that out.
Or clarify,
yeah.
One does not possess another active vacation rental activity permit on same parcel.
Right.
Because I get that, but limiting how many vacation rentals you can, that seems strange to me.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so that
yeah, we'll refine that.
That was the first question. Second question is also on vacation.
I have a question six.
Believe it is down.
Yeah, okay.
Expiration and renewal of permits.
Mm-hmm.
The letter A. Is this proposed, or did the supervisors already decree that vacation use permits are valid for 3 years and then have the ability to be renewed?
Yeah, that's a board of supervisor.
So that has already been approved mm-hmm. by the supervisors?
Yep, it's every 3 years. And remember, because it's an administrative permit, so the way they were looking at it as, you know, not a standard use permit, land use entitlement, and they wanted to build in inspections, you know, within those 3 years to keep up on any, like, property issues that a vacation rental may have. So I know that was some, you know, that was basis for them wanting it to be a three-year reoccurring permit. And so pretty much what would happen typically after the 3 years, property owner would come to us for, you know, a reissuance. There would be a quick inspection and it would be approved on a 3 year basis. Yeah.
Okay. And I remember we had the discussion back when we were looking at the housing element.
Yes.
Specifically on vacation rentals about setting some type,
I know you guys were, I think you were divided on it, but I know from my memory, I think, but yeah, the board, that's something they elevated.
So it has been codified?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a question too, also.
Yes. Commissioner Hill?
On the 60 and 030, it says on paragraph 9, a statement confirming that the operation of a vacation rental is not prohibited by a restrictive covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In that covenant, it says no commercial or business activity allowed. Would that reject that vacation rental?
Right. So it's ensuring, like, for example, Lake Shastina doesn't allow for vacation rentals on their parcels, which would, you know, be
but
defined
if,
as
if it
that
doesn't say vacation rental, it says no business activity.
Right.
That would include vacation rental?
No, because... the way that the county, and this is something supported by the Board of Supervisors, is they look at vacation rental activity as a commercial, as a business, right? You're operating a business out of a home. So that is, you know, at the most basic, it's a commercial activity.
If it did say no business activity, then the vacation rental would fall into that?
Yeah, they would, and then they would not be allowed to occur.
Okay. Anything else on vacation rentals? Okay. Then let's move top to bottom, or bottom to top then. So vacation rentals, and then, oh gosh, now I'm out of whack. Hold on a second.
I did somewhat go out of order of how
that's
it was
fine.
Presented in the draft.
My sign question is written in the next.
Yeah, I would say signs. I have a few questions about signs, if there's nothing else on vacation rentals.
The meat of the signs comes, though.
To clarify.
It comes after. It's actually going to be in part three. That's where
I'm on 10.90. Yeah.
You're ahead where I am.
Okay. I'm just going by my comments in the PDF, so. Okay.
Vice Chair Linder.
Yeah.
To clarify, it is in our current Article 61 that the way it's phrased an application for a vacation activity permit must be made by the property owner who does not presently possess any other vacation rental activity permit. And so we might want to clarify then, if the intent isn't to only allow them to have one, that they may have multiple.
Yeah, I think that was an incorrect carryover and it wasn't defined properly.
Because
yeah.
I know of numerous people that have more than one.
Yeah.
You do. So, okay. Yeah, let's clarify that. Good catch. Okay, so on the signs section, I am on
55.
No, see 94.
Oh, you're in the next part. We haven't got part three yet.
Okay, let me go back up.
Correct.
Apologies, bear with me here.
While she's looking, I do have a question. It's referenced in the sign permit 10.55, I believe, in one other place. There's a reference to a Part 5 zoning to refer to for allowable, non-allowable, or compliant. That Part 5 zoning, is that the one that comes way later down about around page 200 and something?
Yes, sir.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
I was making sure it wasn't referring to that zoning table that was up in part
five. Oh, understood. Okay. Yeah, no, the part five of the zoning.
Oh, okay. Sir.
Sorry, I'm lost. Most of my sign questions were in the sign section, like 10.9 and on.
That's part three.
Okay.
And that's part three. So, yeah, let's.
Yeah.
I do like the pre-application meeting edition, though. I think that's going to be helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, through the chair. And this is something we institute informally, but it just would be nice to formalize it just to let the public know, because as you all know, it's so helpful when we have just all hands on deck, you know, even if Public Works needs to be involved or whoever, and it makes the process way easier for everybody.
But let me go through what you... So you elect to have a pre-application hearing. Do you have to do that, or could you go directly?
You don't have to. It's just an option.
But if you're denied, then you have to pay $1,250 to go to the Planning Commission, right?
No, so the pre-application meeting is just to ensure that the applicant is aware of all of the regulations and requirements for their project, or if they need assistance further developing their scope of work, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we...
But to appeal that decision...
No, it's like a pre-consultation
before
you
submit. Yeah, it's
not
an approval.
It's just
okay.
A meeting.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're allowing the opportunity to meet before you submit.
Yeah.
To make sure that you're submitting a full packet.
Yes.
Okay.
To help.
And no decisions made.
Right.
No. This is just an advisory.
All right.
Yeah.
It sounded to me like that if a decision was made that they had to appeal it.
That's after it's already been submitted.
Yeah.
Okay.
After it's submitted, and then there's the appeal.
Okay. And I think you may be thinking of the AUP.
Yeah.
Administrative use permit,
yeah,
then that would be an appealable deal.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had projects in the past where we've had project proponents. Well, if I'd known this was going to occur, it's like, okay, that pre-application meeting would have solved that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my sign stuff is actually way later, so I'll go to my questions on, it's B, let's see, I'll give you a page, page 24, if you grew up a bit. So there under B, the application contents, B3, says the applicant shall certify the accuracy and completeness of the submitted materials. So how does that work? And I think that's a question for staff. How would that work if, say, an owner builder hired an engineer or an architect to design plans and then submitted the packet? It says, you know, the applicant, i.e. the landowner, shall certify that it's accurate and complete. Mm-hmm. How do you do that if, like, that's outside of your realm as an owner builder? And then two, is there a hammer if something's not accurate and complete?
Right, so that's for building permits, right? So that's a little different. So for example, this is for like our planning application. So a use permit, right? It's the, you know, for a project, it's the property owner certifying, yes, this is the project we're applying for.
Okay,
you
gotcha.
And not, we're not gonna come back next week. You know, we apply for a vacation rental or something and then we're gonna come back next week. Oh no, we actually really wanna do a resort, you know?
Understood that, okay.
It's more to that.
Okay, I just wanted to double check what they were certifying.
Sure.
And then, let's see. So, and then under C2, if the planning director determines that the application cannot lawfully be approved under the general plan, or constitutes a resubmittal of a previously denied application, the director may reject the application prior to deeming it complete and shall provide written notice. So if something, so in my head, I'm trying to rectify why it would, if they're resubmitting, assuming they have all the new necessary info, but yet it would automatically go to rejection. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah,
like what's that trigger?
It's just to cover all bases. Right, so example, you know, locally we don't have cannabis regulations, right? Let's say someone just submits or keeps submitting to operate, you know, like cannabis retail or something, right? We would just keep rejecting that, like, no, you don't have this availability in our county regulations. And I know that's an extreme example, but it's really just to cover our basis. Like, if you're applying for something that we don't locally allow or the state doesn't allow or something, right? You know, we have the authority to reject those efforts.
So you're not accepting it for filing is basically what you're doing.
Right.
Okay, and that's
right.
That out. Okay, I just wanted to make sure I clarified that.
Yeah.
And then, let's see here. And then, okay, under 1020.07, determination of completeness, item 1, A1. Within 30 calendar days of application submittal, the applicant shall be notified in writing that the application is complete, blah, blah, blah. Is that current?
So that's per the Permit Streamlining Act of like the 70s. So that's for use permits and everything. We are required, and we do follow that by law, to let them know within 30 days if their application is complete or if we need further review.
I may need to chat with you.
Yeah.
Oh, fine. Okay.
While we're in that, it says source new on the very last line, an applicant may appeal a determination of incompleteness in accordance with this.
Mm-hmm.
Who's that, that appeal, does it come to us? Or is it an appeal with the individual who made the determination?
It would be Planning Commission.
Okay,
right?
So so if Mr. Phelps, I'm gonna put you in the hot seat here. Mr. Phelps determines that a project's incomplete to Mr. Smith, and Mr. Smith says, no, I'm appealing that, it would not go to you, it would come to us?
Correct.
Okay.
I think the actual way it would work, it's just in the office, if someone did come in and disagreed with us saying if the application was incomplete and they say no, it's in, we would reconsider it first before it escalated.
Right.
Because we have, may have made a mistake.
Okay.
You know, once we confirm no, we looked at it, it is correct, it is incomplete, this is why it's incomplete, and we can't resolve it, then we would escalate it to the planning commission.
Mm-hmm.
But ideally, you want to reconsider before escalating it.
Because I guess I ask that because with the mindset, we're trying to make things easier, less expensive, and not have an agenda before this commission of 30 frivolous projects.
Totally.
It would make sense to me that if one of our planning staff, i.e. Mr. Phelps, made a determination that it should go to the director.
Right.
Now, if a director makes the determination it's incomplete, then by all means appeal to the commission. But I'd hate to see an appeal of a staff person come straight to us without going to you first.
Yes, and as James was stating, you know, the practicality of it, we work with people, we let them know, hey, you're incomplete because of A, B, and C. You know, this would be, I think, a very uncommon process, you know, difficult person.
I'm just thinking outside.
Totally. And I just want to clarify too with the Permit Streamlining Act, you know, that's specific to like our planning projects, right? So we are required by law to let you know in 30 days if your application is complete, not if it's been, you know, not if we're in process of it, we've reviewed it, it's going to be approved or denied. It's just you have submitted everything to us complete in full or not complete in full.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not that if you need more information.
Yeah, and that
okay,
can
that's,
extend
that was
it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you. Any other questions on part two, Commissioner? Okay. Part three, please.
All right. Moving right along to part three. We're going to get into the general development standards. The idea is that these would be standards that would apply really countywide, regardless of your zoning or the use specifically. So, this part establishes the development standards, those types of development standards. It establishes basic standards for site and building area, how to calculate these. And really the idea here is that these provisions are just gonna help ensure structural safety, kind of compliance with building code, and really enforce and bring in those best practices when it comes to general applicability of standards. So this part is organized as follows. We have our general site development standards, reference out to landscaping, parking standards, fences and walls, signs, and then general performance standards. So what has changed? We've clarified how structure, height, and setbacks are measured. Really, we went and spoke with building, see how they end up measuring it on their end, and made those consistent. That way you don't get into a situation where planning is assessing height one way, and then when you actually get into the building permit aspect, it's being interpreted differently. So we've made those consistent. Really, that's being measured from the average finish grade to the highest point of a structure, and we've provided some clarifying figures to help explain that as well. We've also established some certain exceptions to the height limits. These are really practical exceptions: chimneys, water towers, silos, kind of these structures that would normally go beyond an established height within a zone. We've created a process by which applicants can request additional height beyond what is established. And then we've established exceptions to setbacks or encroachments. What can go into an established setback required by your zone, whether that be eaves or bay windows or AC equipment, kind of creating that category of what are we okay with being within the setback if it's not kind of a structure oriented. One of the larger changes, and not too much of a change, but is one that's really required out of state law consistency, but we have a new section for, is landscaping. So the state requires, state of California requires, that jurisdictions either adopt their own landscaping provisions or they default to the state's model ordinance. It's called MWELO. And really this sets water efficiency requirements for landscaping of qualifying types. This is already a state-mandated process. What we are doing is simply saying that we are consistent with the state process. We're not providing any other additional standards in this section. We tie back to the state-regulated land uses. we are simply establishing, saying Siskiyou County is in compliance. We understand the county has these MLO requirements. We are finding that we are consistent with those, and we are saying that we are going to process and review applications consistent with that. Beyond state compliance, we are not recommending any other additional landscaping changes for a rural county. That is not something that has been requested that would go beyond the state's standards at this point.
What about Zone Zero?
Zone Zero, I'm sorry?
CAL FIRE Zone Zero that was just enacted.
So those would still be 100% applicable to the property. These would just be additional landscaping requirements. So CAL FIRE, defensible space requirements, all of those would still have to be complied with and still enacted, and would still be properties would still be subject to those. This is just more from a zoning perspective. Community development is saying we're not going to apply any additional standards on top of those which are already.
Okay, thank you.
In this part, we also consolidated all of the existing parking standards that exist and are kind of spread throughout the code. Really, this is establishing number of parking spaces for land uses. This is a very traditional zoning mechanism. And here we also are establishing various access points for ingress and egress to sites, just really kind of best practices. We've added a new section for consideration for on-site loading requirements for commercial land uses. So as opposed to having trucks offloading in the middle of streets, creating a requirement that larger scale commercial operations have to provide loading facilities so it's not a public burden on the public right of way. And then we've also provided some and clarified some parking space dimensional standards and drive aisle standards, acknowledging that this is a rural county, you have larger vehicles, suburban or urban standards aren't really applicable, don't make sense here. So not much really is changing in far as our recommendations on reducing things as much as it is really accommodating the lifestyle that is up in Siskiyou. You'll notice in the parking regulation section, we find a much more of a user-friendly format and for consolidating all of your parking regulations for your land uses. As the commission is aware, every land use has a corresponding number of parking spaces that it has to provide for its customers. We looked at what is best practice to alleviate, the attempt is to eliminate the burden of overparking. We see that that is something that has traditionally been done and required by zoning codes, in which you have seas of parking lots that really end up being used in some situations. So we tried our best to look at what is best practice, what makes sense in the county, and refining those requirements. And in most cases, what we did is we reduced the amount of parking spaces required. We also then clarified how to calculate parking spaces, because it depends on the type of use. Are you doing it based on square footage? Are you doing it based on number of seats, fixed seats, movable seats? Really wanted to create a clear process so you have an understanding and applicants know how many parking spaces am I required. Kind of a silly topic to think about that we're experts in zoning, but parking very much is part of the development typology and really shapes the urban fabric of development. And then, as mentioned, we proposed some additional standards for commercial facilities and their loading requirements. A lot of the times this is already brought in as best practice for developers. Think of a grocery store has a back-end receiving area. A lot of this is already built into the design typologies, but what we're proposing is this is actually a requirement, that qualifying projects that hit that threshold end up having to provide some sort of on-site loading facility. The intent, again, is to remove that requirement off of the public right-of-way in situations where we're having potential safety concerns with trucks and people moving back and forth. This would not be a requirement that would be required for existing development. This would just be for new development in the future coming in, and again, for larger scale facilities, not small, single stores or commercial operations.
So really quickly, you just said for new construction for the parking, but what about like if it's a major remodel? Does that have to be brought up to code with the parking?
Typically, that could be an issue. And I know there's, like on the building, you know, code side of things, there's parameters, like if it's a certain increase and type of increase, and like, for example, if it's a commercial space where there's employees? Are you increasing more employees to be at a location? So there's, you know, certain parameters they look at determining if, you know, there needs to be more parking or not.
So on a vacation rental application with 5 acres, there would be no parking requirements at all, right?
There's parking requirements for vacation rentals based on the, you know, maximum allowable people that are on property, and that likely wouldn't change based on, you know, septic and things like that, unless the house was like teared down and built larger, but yeah.
So I think when you said, did you just say that it wouldn't require a park, you reduce the number of parking requirements on large parcels, isn't that what you said?
Overall, our goal was to reduce the amount of mm-hmm. parking countywide that would be required. Mm-hmm. Vacation rentals, in this case, I believe that we did not propose any recommendations to reduce parking space requirements. We were really looking at more of your commercial activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be cumbersome sometimes.
And in the event that, kind of with the understanding that this would be for new development, Cherry, you bring up a very good point about, okay, what about existing and what threshold? So if we played out the event in which there was a redevelopment of an existing property, and let's say this trigger did come in for a loading space requirement, we still have those other tools that we've built in where an applicant can show and prove, hey, this is actually not feasible for me to construct this loading facility on my site based on parcel size requirements or kind of the SLU, and they can either through a minor deviation, a major deviation, or that variance process, request an exemption for those standards. So we do have this built-in process, understanding that it's not a one-size-all solution here.
Exactly.
And it might be cost burdensome, or may prevent someone from even, some of these things may prevent someone from even going through a renovation, and that's not the intent. Mm-hmm. The intent is to have nicer looking development, bring things up to standards. And so we have these channels, ideally, that someone can apply for and run through in case an event like that does come up, or it would be, in some situations, maybe not even feasible.
Yeah, I'm just thinking some of our unincorporated areas and these older buildings with, you know, tight parking, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Loading zones aren't feasible, right. You know. So, okay, thank you.
Before we move on, since loading zones were brought up, I'm just looking for clarification here. Thinking east side of Scott Valley again and a few locations in Shasta Valley, a number of the loadout structures, i.e. chutes for loading trucks, are within 50-foot setback currently of county roads. Will those be essentially grandfathered as pre-existing non-conforming?
I think so, yeah, unless you're not, you know, drastically changing any operations or buildings or anything like that. Yeah, that would be grandfathered in as existing non-conforming.
Okay. I just want to make sure, because a mm-hmm. lot, a number of those structures have been and will be again in the future improved, okay. i.e. concrete, steel, mm-hmm. from portable, but that is really the only safe location for a semi to load and unload is right there, literally on the county road.
Right, yeah, and remember too, with the non-conforming use section, you are able to improve, you know, up to, you know, certain percentages and things, so I would think that those situations would stay within that wheelhouse.
I just wanted to be clear on that.
Yeah, because yeah, we'll make note of that.
Once
too.
Again, that goes back to my earlier comment about privately owned public.
Mm-hmm.
My neighbor to both sides, we and three down, we all load on the county road when we're loading a semi.
Yeah.
My yeah. uncle did out in Shasta Valley in both locations.
Okay. Yeah, so we'll make note of that to ensure.
So the consultants specifically address that. Basically, for agricultural enterprises or agricultural uses, if you don't need a use permit, there's no parking space requirement.
Okay. I wasn't looking so much for parking. I was looking more for the loading,
mm-hmm.
unloading.
Yeah, yeah.
and the general term commercial, because it's been used in here before, commercial agriculture. I wanted to make sure we're okay.
Okay.
And then within this, before we move on to, from the parking, is there is then the ability for applicants to request a further reduction of parking standards. So we want to increase flexibility, create these opportunities where applicants can, in these unique circumstances, provide a case to the director or the planning commission for a reduction. So we built in that process, applicants can go through that zoning clearance permit that we talked about, and they can request that the planning director reduce to a certain percentage, reduce the parking requirements and parking spaces. So another opportunity here for some flexibility depending on the circumstance. Part three also addresses and brings in some standards for fences and walls, though minimal. So really this section clarifies how to measure fences and walls. This is going to be in compliance with building. We confirmed with them how they would go about measuring it. We clarified when a building permit is required for certain fences. Essentially, when does a structure, when does a fence now become a structure and now is requiring some county review for a building permit. And then we were a little more specific as to allowed and prohibited materials. So as proposed, prohibited materials would include kind of materials that aren't really intended for fencing. Tarps, roofing supplies, pallets. And in this case, we have a recommendation to also limit the use of barbed wire, razor wire, and electrical fence if it's not being used for agriculture or specifically for commercial activities. As just as a consideration.
If you wouldn't mind like focusing on this, I know Commissioner Fow had questions on fencing.
Yeah, these are kind of out of order because I had questions on landscaping also, which is before the fencing. But since we're in fencing, the prohibition of roofing supplies, would that include metal roofing?
I would
under the definition, I'm going to assume yes.
I would open it up to some, maybe even some dialogue as to, I think we have some flexibility there as to how we want to interpret that. I think our intent was using asphalt shingles, asphalt tiles. I think there is a use case for potentially for some, maybe might be going as corrugated metal siding or some of those other types of structural, I would say, architectural elements that we see built into fencing.
Okay,
but something that could be open for consideration.
So I'm going to do a major leapfrog back to when you were describing and brought up the correlation of using a toolbox. And you made the statement just before that zoning does not determine architecture. To me, this, when we start getting into the nuts and bolts of what is prohibited as far as materials go on fences, and you just said it, the architecture of the fence, I thought we weren't going to go there.
Well, architectural elements of a fence, being a corrugated sheet, being an architectural element.
Okay, but at the beginning you said we are not dealing with architecture.
Sure, architectural style. So we're not dictating something has to be modern or contemporary.
I would argue that you here are making an architectural determination of what is allowed. Now, I get shingles, but I think we're headed down a dangerous path when mm-hmm. we start. There are numerous fences in this county that utilize pallets.
Yes.
There are numerous fences in this county that utilize roofing and other roofing supplies that I could see a valid argument why they're being used.
Well, don't marijuana groves have to have tarps?
I'm not going there, Dusty.
No,
I am.
But before we head down that path, I guess I've got a challenge. I have an issue. Which I think is where we're headed here, I hope not, that if I want to use tin or I want to use pallets up for a fence, that now I have to go to the planning director to get approval. I've got a problem with that.
Yeah. And I would say I've got a neighbor who did a gorgeous rusted tin roofing fence with, you know, 4x4, what do they call the square posts? And everything's been like acid washed to look old. And it's a gorgeous fence. So with this definition, because it's a roofing material, it wouldn't be.
Isn't there something that triggers kind of the planning department to get a use permit? Isn't that dictated by height?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if it, if it doesn't meet that height, then what are we talking about?
Well, I think what I see those as two separate things. I see it as you need a permit for height.
That's it.
And then you need a, you need, if you're going to do a pallet fence, you would need a variation, is how I'm reading it.
If that's what's being proposed.
No, as what is in the draft amendment, those would be prohibited fence materials. You wouldn't
you couldn't use them unless you got a variance from the director.
Unless you were to.
So through the chair, are there any materials that you all feel that should be prohibited at all, just to make note of it formally, or not, or just any and all materials as long as they meet the state height? If not, you would have to apply for a permit.
And I get that the bulk of this is focused on residential.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. But I see, as we discussed earlier, grading ordinance, the potential ramifications that could stem from a residential limitation to how it would apply on AG.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what causes me consternation is electric, if not used for agriculture or required. Okay, great, it says specifically ag here, but I can see the day that if we have it in our general plan that you cannot use electric fence on rural residential, maybe it's a 40-acre rural residential,
mm-hmm.
And they have livestock, and it is allowable, why do they have to go to the planning director to get approval for that? By right, you should be able to use electric fence on your property.
Well,
I'm sorry.
And then back to that general plan discussion where we were talking about horses not used for ag are technically not ag.
Mm-hmm.
That's a primary way of fencing on horse property is electric tape or electric wire fence. So limiting that just to ag is also potentially an issue, you know, because horses aren't.
The only time you have to get a permit for a fence is if it's above a standard height.
Yes.
Or what about, as is proposed, if you want to use any of those prohibited materials, you would have to go get approval.
Well, what's the standard height in county?
Seven feet.
Seven or less.
Seven or less.
Eight on ag.
Eight on ag.
Anything above that's considered a structure. So for building code,
it has to be
have to make sure it's structurally sound.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can to the chair, I think part of this discussion here, and I'm hearing what you're saying, Commissioner Fowle, is if this is, again, it's just a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
If this is too restrictive, there are ways to strip this out to where it doesn't have those restrictions, and it's whatever material is available, as long as it complies with the height and the setback of fence, then it moves forward.
Yeah.
So those can be removed.
Yeah.
Some of this just reflects our experience in some other rural areas. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that rural area is exactly Siskiyou, but there are some simple fixes to this that I think meets the expectations of the commission's discussion.
Commissioner Hart, do you have something to say?
Yeah, I'm just wondering when the planning department and code enforcement is going to take on, let's see, 7 sections, 1 acre lots, all have fences that are 7 foot and higher that incorporate just about everything right there.
Well, that's,
you
that's,
know the legal nightmare that's going to happen here?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
That's specifically why this is in there. If you don't have something that says prohibited materials, I can build a fence made out of old cars.
Yeah, I know.
All the way down. I mean, no, that's not a junkyard. That's a fence of cars. Yeah, you know. So that's why this this clause is in there, I would hesitate removing that. I mean, you could clarify what types of roofing materials if you wanted to be more specific, but that's specifically what we're trying to prevent. Like, they could stack all their garbage out and be like, no, that's a fence. You can't.
Okay, I understand that. Yeah. Council?
Yeah, I was just going to comment sort of about the fence of the cars. This is the first time I've read this section. I'll note it also says any other unconventional materials determined to be prohibited by the planning director. So it leaves it very open-ended. For better or worse, I mean, someone who did build a fence of cars, it could be determined to be improper.
Or art.
Or ours. Or his, yeah. I'm just saying.
Once you put this in place, if you do it that way, then how do you deal with all of that that's out there?
That allows us to go out and say you are in violation of this specific code section. We can cite you.
But will it apply to what currently exists? Because this is coming after it has been built. I think that's the...
No, you can't have a non-conforming use that's still prohibited.
Pre-existing non-conforming, we have them all the time. And they could very easily make the legal argument, hey, we have this fence of tarp and razor wire and it was granted the elevation. Okay, that is not allowable right now. But as far as materials go, that's a pre-existing non-conforming, as long as it's under the height.
I'll have to look at our current code section. I don't have access to my computer now, but I do recall we already have something similar in our code.
In our current, let me see.
And I would imagine we do, because it would make sense not to have something like this in your code, because, again, if you don't have some sort of requirements, it's similar to a house. If we don't have requirements, you have to build your houses out of certain materials. I'm going to build it out of cheese.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, understood. Yeah.
You know, so the concerns for agriculture specifically, I know that's addressed in Section B of that same section, Commissioner Bow, you know, like the different types of electrical fencing allowed. We try to leave it open just because you never know what will come up, so we want a code that is flexible, that will work for the community and not be rigid.
Okay.
Again, if there's roofing materials that make sense, like we do see those, you know, very stylish, you know, fences that are using the roofing material, but they're not using the asphalt shingles, but maybe they're using the wood shingles, that would be appropriate.
And I've seen some actually really nice pallet fences, you know, especially, you know, like internal fences for like kids' 4-H animals, you know, it's very common. So I understand, personally, I understand the objective, because we don't, but then how do we accommodate that and then allow flexibility? Because,
good.
You know, I don't know how to round that corner, but, you know, and even like tarps, like I could say, okay, the big blue tarp is an eyesore. That's my personal judgment. But yet, I've seen some of those like fabric fences where they're like the shade cloth and they're like in redwood and they're sandwiched. Those look nice.
Yeah.
So, but it's subjective. So, I don't know how to regulate subjective and allow flexibility. So, all ears.
Did we take a time out for, we haven't reached the questions portion yet.
I have not yet. I have.
No, we just
I have more on fences and walls, but I'll wait till questions come up.
Okay. Yeah, let's, sure.
I'll let you finish this and then I've got several more questions.
Yeah, let's circle back. Thank you.
Absolutely. So the next two items in here are just addressing signs specifically. Really, this is not necessarily a state mandated review that we did, but really a First Amendment free speech review that we did. So there is a lot of prior court cases regarding protected speech when it comes to signs and what jurisdictions can and cannot prevent on signs. And specifically, the First Amendment prohibits jurisdictions from regulating content. So we went through with the lens of providing content-neutral regulations and revising a lot of the existing standards to ensure that we're not regulating content and potentially creating some inconsistency with First Amendment protections. We established in this process, in doing so, we further clarified existing sign standards. the permits that you would have to get, your sign permit, what would then trigger potentially an administrative use permit, depending on the type of sign that you're requesting for. And then we also establish prohibited sign types. These would be for your consideration, for also comment on what are signs that we aren't interested in seeing versus signs that we want to encourage. And then we updated the permit requirements. We looked at some of the design standards for signs and brought those up to best practice. And then we clarified some of those permit thresholds. What is requiring a sign permit versus a higher level administrative use permit that would have to go to the director and be approved. Not much, though, really substantially changed in this section besides us really wanting to make sure that we're compliant at a minimum with free speech protections. The last portion of this part has to do with performance standards, in which we have established some new standards, ideally more objective standards for glare, lighting, vibration, sewage system, streets, easements, odor, and all of these would be basic operational performance standards that land uses would have to comply with, at least at a bare minimum. We have something that county staff can point to. Really, the ideas of these performance standards is to further implement the public welfare, health, safety, as we discussed, as the really the antithesis for your police powers of enacting this code. So in here, you'll see new standards and some revised language when it comes to these types of activities to ensure that we are remaining compliant. So with that will conclude part three, and I will hand it back to the chair for questions and comments.
Okay. Commissioner Fowle, we'll start with you on questions.
Okay. So I'm going to start back on fences and walls. Scrolling back. Right here, page 87.
What's the
10? It is under 10.85.040 height limitations, but it's B, and it's where a non-residential use, I'm going to say field, farm, abuts a residential zoning district, school, or public park, a solid fence or wall at least 6 feet in height shall be installed and maintained along the shared property line. I know of 7 instances where you have either ag or timber zones abutting a school. And currently it's a 5-strand or 6-strand barbed wire fence. Mm-hmm. And that is the shared property line. Are we going to say that if this moves forward, that there's going to have to be a 6-foot high wall built along those shared property lines?
You brought up a good point, and I think we will need to change this. This section, if you think more like in the city, like you might have a big shopping center next to housing development, they have
that. I get
used.
That.
So that's what this was from, but you brought it to the Siskiyou County setting, and we will have to adjust that for that.
Okay.
Is that an incorporated city?
Does that make sense?
One of the schools is within an incorporated that abuts an alfalfa field. The other school abuts an orchard grass alfalfa field. In fact, it's surrounded on 3 sides by a hay field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like James mentioned, we can reword it to speak to more of like the commercial aspect,
okay.
A Dollar General or some prey, you know, yeah. Want some fencing and or industrial development, something like that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
My next comment is on the next section down, residential zones. We have instances downriver out in Quartz Valley where there are residential zoned parcels that are next to county maintained, i.e. public roads, mm-hmm. where cattle are driven mm-hmm. to and from mountains, coming out of the mountains, 3 feet in height is not sufficient. I guess we have a right to farm, which deals with activities on the farm or ranch, but limiting, let me back up. The general saying is if you don't want cattle on your lawn, fence them out. If we're going to say that, then we cannot limit the homeowner to a 3 foot high fence. They should be able to build a 5-strand barbed wire or a 4 foot or 5 foot wood slatted fence, whatever they want to do, as long as they're not over 7, requiring a building permit, I get that. But we should not be limiting to 3 feet where it's along county roads, even state highways, mm-hmm. where cattle are coming out of the mountains, being right. driven to and from pastures.
Right.
We can't do that.
Right.
I have a problem with that.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not safe, actually.
So I think this is a good example of why this meeting was good. So maybe the correction would be, instead of residential zones, we were more specific to which districts. That might resolve it. Because you could see like a minimum fence height in an urban setting or a town setting. Like at night, you're thinking public safety issues, the police need to jump over, whatever.
But we don't have control of the fence heights in the city of Atlanta.
No, I'm using that example, like, say, Greenview.
Well, it's McLeod, right?
Or McLeod.
Okay.
Yeah, you know.
McLeod's unique. I would get McLeod, but even the unincorporated outskirts of Etna going up the mountain, it's residential. It shouldn't have 3 foot minimum or maximum.
So we might not want to put that in maybe like rural residential and maybe put it more into like the mixed residential.
Like what, like the res ones and twos? Or?
You know what we're talking about.
You just need to be cautious here because, yeah. And City of Etna or Greenview, I look at Quartz Valley,
mm-hmm.
Between Haydens, Pimentel, Morris, I mean, start running down mm-hmm. the permits that are coming out of the mountains, looking at Etna.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got Hammond, Hayden, etc.
Mm-hmm.
coming down through Etna,
mm-hmm.
And it. I've got a problem with this.
Yeah. Well, and just look at all.
Be careful.
All the residences on Old Stage Road, you know, that abuts Old Stage Road, which is county, and you've got all those residential going through Mount Shasta Weed. A 3 feet fence isn't going to keep their dogs in.
That's what I'm saying. It might not be appropriate for rural residential.
Yeah.
Which those areas would be zoned that. So we might just restrict it to, you know, like the mixed residential or something where the density was higher.
Like an actual subdivision.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Typically you say for traditional, and I say traditional, and that could be subjective in nature, but so traditional, like single family neighborhoods where you don't see the front yards completely walled up where you're going down the street and you don't see the houses because the intent is to bring it down for visibility and safety issues. I think there's a way to modify the language to more of your subdivision, or
yeah.
I'm going to use the word suburban style
mm-hmm.
development.
Yeah.
Remove it from any rural residential, not applicable to ag that has residential. I think there's a way to do that,
mm-hmm.
to modify that language.
Yeah.
Okay.
I still do believe it does have a time and place in specific styles of development,
exactly.
but not all development patterns.
Yeah. No, and I think we're all in agreement. You know, the typical subdivision where everybody's got their quarter acre, 10th
sure.
acre lot, whatever it looks like, wouldn't need this.
Yeah.
Sure.
Or
sure.
This would be applicable.
Yeah, and
but.
To think in the future, if we did have, you know, subdivision development, it could be a good starting point for, you know, when they're developing those lots of what we would allow.
Yeah.
And